Some people count themselves as extremely lucky to escape one brush with death. Then there are others like Richie Oliver, otherwise known as Punter, who somehow managed to survive too. In this fascinating podcast, Richie recalls vividly just what it was like to be involved in two near-fatal accidents, all in the space of 12 months. He also talks about just what he's learned from the confronting experiences. The strength and determination, not to mention inner knowing, that Richie managed to find is almost unimaginable, and he's not afraid to admit he's human and his physical and mental recovery is still a work in progress. Today I'm here with Richie Oliver. Thanks so much, Richie, for joining me. Ironically, it is the 29th of June 2020 when Richie closed the door of his extremely busy business back in 2018. Quite ironic that we'd be sitting here together now, and a bit's happened since then. So, Richie, what have you got to fill us in on today? Where do we start?
Well, I suppose we start the journey of closure of the business. It was Blue Lake Hire, event business. Mm-hmm. Did weddings and 21st field days, that sort of stuff. We'd been in it for 16 or 17 years. I'm not 100% certain on that. And the business was one of those businesses that it went very well. It grew in our time that we were there. And I suppose for 2 years before that, I was in partnership with another person called Jack Jamison, who now lives in Darwin, but he still does our financials and all that sort of stuff. But we always thought, how are we going to get out of this business, knowing well that event hire businesses around Australia just weren't selling. No one was buying them. The amount that was for sale that just basically shut their doors and walked away. So we couldn't see any way out of it, so we just sort of thought, well, we'll just keep going the way we were. But we were fortunate in that we, over that period of time, probably the last 4 or 5 years we were there, the business just grew and grew and grew. But unfortunately, it outgrew us. It was became a big business. And probably for a town the size of Narracourt, staffing it, all those sort of things became issues. But yeah, it just became that we were basically doing every event in the southeast, which accumulated at the end of doing Generations in Jazz. We did that for the last 3 or 4 years, and that is a monstrous job. And so we had to get help in to do that, which we did. We used to get Warrnambool Party Hire in and get other equipment from other companies. Anyhow, it was, I suppose it was the last year I was there. We were in the business. I just remember thinking, this is just too big for me. Like, how am I going to get out of it or whatever? And just by coincidence, talking to the boys from Warrnambool Party Hire, I said to them, jokingly, saying that you need to take this over from me, this job and whatever and everything, so I can get out of it. But they obviously had a bit of a thought about it and came back. We talked things through. So all of a sudden, within 2 months, a decision was made. And consequently, we got out of it, and being the right decision, the right time, I was 57 then.
You'd done enough, 90-hour weeks.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Those days, it, when we first bought the business, it was a summer business. But it turned into bigger than that. And then all of a sudden, it just – yeah, it accumulated my whole life. It just took over. And I found myself going to work every morning, 4:30 or 5:00, and getting home at 9:00 and those sort of things, and that's 7 days a week. And it's hard work. It was hard work. As much as it was great work, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed travelling all around, meeting people. But, there's a time comes where you've got to take a bit of a step back and think, look after yourself and your family, and spend some time with people. And we got out of it on the closure date was June the 29th. And unfortunately, that was where the rest of my life changed.
Yeah, so the closure date for the business was June the 29th. So you literally had your knockoff drink And then the next day.
A lot of people basically don't go like going cutting wood and stuff like that. But for me, that was my time. I'd go and do it. I enjoyed it. A job that probably should have taken me 2 hours or 3 hours used to take me 5 and 6 because I'd just go out, do my own little thing, go for a wander around, whatever. Always had my phone on me, and where I cut wood, I always let them know that I was coming out by either message or whatever, leaving a voicemail on their phones. So I had it out, and the amazing thing about that day was my wife at the time had a bad back and hip, and as in pinched nerve, and it had gone down her leg. So she was struggling a bit with it. And when I sort of not thinking anything or knowing anything, but I said to her, I said, oh, look, tomorrow I'm going to go out and cut some firewood. And that was all fine. But the amazing thing was down the track she actually said to me, she said, for some reason, when you said that to me, I didn't want you to go out there and do it. She said, I got no idea why that I felt that. So, but anyhow, I went out and did it. Now, that day, for some reason, I didn't let the people that owned the property know that I was going out there. Why I didn't do that, I don't know.
Something you'd always done.
So, always done. Always done. The other thing was my phone, I always had it in my pocket. Just in case there was an accident or something went wrong. And that day I didn't. I left it in the ute. Why? Don't know. And a bit of a weird thing to it was the paddock that I was in cutting the wood, I knew that that was the end of these people's property, but I knew the next door neighbour was over there in his paddock marking lambs. And I looked over a few times. Why I did that? Don't know. But I did look over a few times over there. I'd been, I suppose, cutting wood for about an hour or so, and I went up and there was this log laying on the ground, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's a nice solid piece, and I'll get a bit out of it. Just behind it was a tree that was basically 10 metres high, dead, everything like that, and had a fork, just one limb hanging off to the side of it. And I looked at it. Why? I looked at it. Once again, don't know, whatever. So I started cutting this log, and I'd probably cut about 6 or 7 pieces off, and I stopped to stand up and have a break, just to stand up. And just from nowhere, bang, the tree fell off, fell over, the limb fell off this tree above me, and just split my scalp open. And I never actually went to the ground. I knew that. I was half conscious, I suppose. I looked down and I had 3 fingers that were going in the wrong directions and whatever, but that wasn't it. It was the pain in my head. I knew what had happened. I knew a limb had fallen. It's one of those things, the pain I'll never ever be able to describe because for a start it was just like, someone hit you with something that you just couldn't believe, but then it went into numbness, but then it would come back. And I automatically thought, I'm in a bit of trouble here. Even though that at this stage I'd stood up completely, and I thought, I'm in trouble. Then I noticed my face went all hot, and I thought, righto, so what's happening here? And I realised it was just blood pouring down my face. I thought, the next door neighbour that was there was Stephen Kelly, nicknamed Ned. I knew he was there, and I thought, I've got to get to him. I somehow have to get to him, but knowing that there was no gate between me and him. So I thought, right, I'll get to the ute. I obviously became a little bit unconscious or whatever, or blacked out, but still walking, and I looked up. I knew where the ute was, and I made my way that way, and all of a sudden I was looking and thought, where'd the ute go? And I thought, oh, no, I'm walking around in circles, and I've obviously been, I'm thinking I've been unconscious or something or other, and I've got no idea where I am and what's going. But I had this streaming feeling all the time of on my face and hot, and I wiped it. I went to wipe it or touch it, and I realised that it was blood over my eyes, and I couldn't see where I was going. So I cleared the blood away from my left eye, and I thought, oh, yeah, there's the ute, no worries. And I thought, well, what's going on with the right? Why won't it clear? And then all of a sudden I put my hand a little bit higher up and I just had all this looseness feeling. I thought, what is that?
Mm.
And I realised it was my scalp had fallen off my head on the right-hand side. So it was over my eye and I thought, right, I've got to focus up because I wear glasses for long and short. So it would have been blurry anyhow, but, of course, with that it was an issue. So I actually, as gross as it sounds, I actually grabbed my scalp and picked it up and pulled it back over my head.
Sounds gross, but sounds smart to me.
Well,
it's and amazing it is, you thought to do that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you've got to make either you buckle or you've got to make a decision.
Mm.
And I think I'd already, in my own mind, thought, I'm in huge trouble here. If I don't get to med, I've got no hope.
Mm.
Even though I thought, I'm not even going to get to med, but I've got to have a crack at it. So I can't remember the rest of the ute, walking to the ute. I don't remember that at all. And obviously it was in my own mind. I just sort of thought, well, Ned's got to drive me. And all of a sudden I realised I was in the passenger seat of the ute and I'm thinking, oh, hell. I got to get to Ned. No, I got to drive. I got to get there. So I got out of the passenger seat and went around and got in the driver's seat. And I remember opening the door of getting into the driver's seat, but I don't remember the rest. So I was probably 800 metres in the paddock, I suppose, and I drove over the paddock. Don't remember any of that. But all of a sudden the focus come in and I got it and I got close to the gate. And the gate was only tied on by a piece of wire, but it had a bit of wire underneath it. And I remember going through my mind, will I just ram this gate or not? And then I thought, no, it could get tangled up underneath and whatever, create an issue. So I don't remember getting out, but obviously I got out and opened the gate and everything. But then when I got through the gate, I actually stopped to get out to shut the gate. And I think as I've said many a time, it was just the old farmer coming out and thinking, there's ewes and lambs in here, I've got to shut the gate. And I actually opened the door of the ute and I thought, oh, we'll stuff the ewes and lambs. And I took off. So then I drove down the dirt road for probably, I don't know, what is it, Bitumen Road, probably 200 or 300 metres, and then down the dirt road heading towards where Ned was. But once again, don't remember any of that, that driving. I knew Ned and his wife were out in the paddock. So once I sort of got to their gateway, I just stopped and just sat there with my hand on the horn. And I remember making that decision. Ned obviously clicked straight away that something was happening because he came roaring over in his motorbike, jumped off and actually ran over to the ute. And I was probably where I was, you know, I was a fair way away or whatever, but he ran over and he just took one look and said, God, you've got to get out of here. Don't remember walking or getting into the passenger seat, but obviously I did. He asked his wife what he was doing, but she never heard what he actually said, but just realised once he took off, things were. So we headed in to Narrow Court. And the funny thing was that the blood stopped. Well, I didn't realise that, but Ned told me that the actual, I stopped bleeding. And he thought, well, perhaps that's not a good thing because where is the rest of the blood going to come from or whatever. But at some stage coming in, I obviously became conscious again and I pulled my phone out of my pocket. Now, once again, blurry because I didn't have glasses. I couldn't. But I had a fair idea where the favourites were on the phone and whatever, and I got in there. And I handed it to Ned and I said, oh, Ned, you better introduce and tell her I've had an accident. And anyhow, so he did that and he told her that he had a bit of a cut to the head and perhaps she should ring the hospital that was coming in. So, and it was shortly after that, though, I don't remember him talking to her or anything, but he said I did say something to her. I spoke to him at one stage. And I just remember all of a sudden being conscious, but everything being black. And I just thought, this is it. She's over, or whatever. And I just remember basically putting my head onto the window, on the side window, and thinking, well, I'm going to go. But once again, there was nothing I could do about it. And It was an amazing moment. I want to say amazing moment is I've always feared death.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that moment I was in a good place and all. Mm-hmm. Like, I suppose I didn't think about it. I think I just thought I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. But I think probably the pain-wise, I'd gone into this, you know, I was in shock and whatever. Yep. So, then the next thing I remember is sort of getting the hospital. I think there was some funny incidents coming in, they'd said, but... that would be a bit different, but the amazing thing was he said he got me to the back door to the emergency and he said he opened the door up and he said he found a wheelchair, so he got me on that and he said he took me from where we went, but he said there was some swinging doors and he said I just thought, right, I'm just going to hit them and go straight through it. But he said he didn't realise that there was a bit of metal on the ground underneath. Uh-huh. And he said, so we got airborne going. And away we went. Nurse's medicine, the corridor. Mm-hmm. So once again, I don't remember any of that. But So I went straight in. They did it all, you know, what they had to do, x-rays and all that, and they were pretty amazed that they could see there was actually no skull damage or anything like that and whatever. And where I was lucky in that is that it actually hit me about a centimetre off, dead centre in the head.
Mm-hmm.
If it had hit me perhaps centimetre over, different story.
Yeah.
So the scalps, they're just basically holding the scalp back on, but I've apparently just started pouring out with blood again, bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to stop the bleeding with towels and everything. They made the decision that they think that we'll try and get him back together and see what happens, basically. The amazing thing was, I suppose it was from the time of the accident to 5 hours later, I'm sitting up in bed and dodged a massive bullet. Like it's, you know, I had 44 staples from the front of my head through to the back of my head. To this day, there's still some sore spots on that head. That's 2 years later. That's nothing in the scheme of things. And there's some nerve damage, obviously. The pictures were pretty gross of what I saw of them and everything. But as I said, it was 5 years later, 5 hours later, and Teresa's brother had been down and she rang him and he came back. He was heading back to Adelaide, sorry. And so he came back and I remember him when we were in the room. I remember both Therese and him standing there beside the bed and talking away. And then whether I just shut my eyes, whether whatever, I'm not 100% certain, but I looked up and all of a sudden I saw three doctors at the end of the bed with bits of blank looks on their faces. And I immediately thought, this isn't good. What's going on here? And then there's some nurses there and to the side. Then one of them coming over and said, oh, Therese, you need to leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh. And then I really, for the probably that duration, whatever happened in those next sort of 10, 15 minutes, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was my blood pressure just dropped clean off.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, they couldn't do a real lot about it because I'd had obviously lost a lot of blood and it all went put back and whatever, but for some little miracle, another little miracle happened that it all just started to go back up and everything was good. And then I found myself sitting up a bit at 7:30 in the morning eating breakfast. So why? How?
Sounds like you didn't miss a meal.
No, I missed early.
It's amazing. So you really have dodged a couple of bullets in that time.
There was the hit. Going in out of consciousness, obviously, was great. And that sort of thing. And so there's a couple of issues there, and I got through it. It was that. So that was my first day of being out of my business, and changed things.
Different from the usual celebrations of semi-retirement. How do you even begin to, at that time, sort of piece your life back together and figure out what next? What was sort of the next days and weeks and months like for you?
Because we were tidying up loose ends too. Mm-hmm. So what had happened was the Warrnambool Party hired basically, in short, I suppose, bought two-thirds of our equipment and business. So there was other bits to go. So Well, the only problem I had was, you know, for a week I was pretty ordinary. I didn't go to work for, you know, 4 or 5 days and whatever, obviously.
Gee.
But when I did go to work, it was only for an hour or two, just so I get home, turn around and go again and whatever. Uh-huh. But there was a lot to do. But I think underneath all that, I just thought, yeah, I've dodged a big bullet. I'm pretty fit. Like, I'm not in any way, there's not anything I can't ever do again or whatever. So I thought,
okay,
other than a scar
on
the face, and I thought, you know, this is a pretty lucky little trip, this one. So
right from when you knew you were okay, did you feel pretty optimistic? Is that what you would call it back then? Yeah,
because my two doctors, Dr. Cohen and his daughter-in-law, were the people that she did the sewing up. He was an anaesthetist, and both were very positive right from the get-go. And I think that was right. Like, you know, as Tony Cohen said to me, he said, you know, you've dodged one here. You've had a pretty lucky escape. And he was sort of, as he said, you know, a centimetre over. We might have had a different ball game happening. The fact that you've been hit and there's no skull damage and no, you know, from crack to bruise. There was bruising, but very minimal. Because I actually did, about 8 months later, went out and had a look where it was to the limb. And, yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, it was by myself once again. And I think that's what I wanted. I just wanted to go do it by myself. Mm-hmm. And I went out there and it was there. The limb was sitting there.
Wow.
And I just thought, okay, that's it. And I had a look up and I thought, so how far has that fallen from? And, I tried to sort of, in my head, measure it and sort of, you know, and it would have been 10 metres.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 metres, it's probably 20 centimetres around the piece that broke off and probably 3 metres long.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong place, wrong time. That's all it was. But other side it was okay because it didn't do the damage it could have done.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I suppose once I got back to work, I just knew there was a lot to be done, and I just thought, look, as long as I start off easy and working, this is going to happen, and it's got to be happening. So, because tidying the business up, the loose ends of all the equipment and everything like that, you know, that probably took 4 months. But I enjoyed going there because I knew that part was over in my life and it was moving on. But yes, moving on from business, but also from the accident.
Mm-hmm.
I was moving on. So I was pretty I went to work pretty happy. I was in a pretty good space really at that time.
And so looking back at around that time on reflection, what would you say were the biggest learning curves from that particular?
Don't go cutting wood by yourself.
Yeah, okay. I think a few people have taken a leaf out of your book, haven't they?
Yeah, when it was on Facebook and stuff like that. Yeah, it was amazing. The amount of people said, hey, Dad, read this.
Yeah,
you know, whatever. Exactly. And as I said, it was always my time.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But things changed a bit.
Yeah.
You make sure that you've got everything in place because, it's like anything. Sometimes you only get one crack at life, but
apparently,
as you'll find out, I get a few.
And so that's unbelievable. And I think if you just slow down and think about all those things that happened that maybe might not have happened, you know, like Ned being in the paddock next to you and all of those, there's so many things that lined up for you that may not have lined up for someone else.
No, that's right. And it was from the actual moment of the accident, and we'll see a bit later on the same thing, but everything went my way. Like it wasn't, you know, so you get this smack, but then, you know, there was almost like a reward on the way through because just everything went right.
Yeah.
Nothing went wrong.
It's amazing.
You know,
and
it could have at any stage.
Yes.
For whatever reasons.
Yeah.
It was a bit even like Ned's made the story. We used to have these 1-ton utes at work. Well, they were always light in the back end. And if you didn't never driven one, you'd always have a little bit of an experience somewhere. So he's thinking, we're on this dirt road and he's flying in to get me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you don't know, but he said, we went around the corner and I thought, geez, we're in trouble here because the back of the. So he had to sort of slow up and whatever. But he said, when you got someone with their scalp hanging off the side of their head, he said, well, you just don't think of those things.
Yes, of course. You're in fight or flight. Stress response kicks in. Yeah. You just do what you've got to do.
So I think, you know, I mean, as I said, everything went my way. So, you know, you look back at it and you go, right, that was right. I mean, OH&S in workplaces, you know, so huge now. And I'd be the first to admit that we weren't great on it.
Mm-hmm.
We did as much as we sort of needed to do, but we certainly didn't force issues or anything like that and whatever. And you look at it now and you think, I used to just go cutting wood with earmuffs on because that's all I know. I wore glasses, so I didn't need them or whatever. But then you think, well, I should have a proper helmet type thing with a guard on and everything like that. Would it have been any better? I wouldn't have been split open, or, you know, or whatever. I don't know all those answers.
Hindsight.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, you learn from it. Perhaps do things a bit better.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So that was 2018.
Yep.
And then in 2019, I tried to line you up for a podcast in about June 2019.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure I was sitting down with my first podcast interviewee, and it was the day you had your second accident. What are the chances of that? Yeah, can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and it makes the first accident look like nothing. So, yeah, I got out of the business, and things were starting to tidy up pretty well. And a job got advertised at the golf club. As an assistant greenskeeper, and I've quite often said if ever there was something that I wished I'd have done younger, it would have been a curator or something like that. I would have loved it. So I've seen this job get advertised for 30 hours a week, and I'm thinking, wow, how good is that? That's 60 less than
all that. That's like almost a tropical island.
Yeah. and I just saw it and I thought, I've got to get this. I thought, how in the hell am I going to get this? So I told my wife about it, Therese, and I said, I've got to apply for this job. This is just, this is me. This is what I want. This is the way I'd like to finish off work and everything. And I got a little bit anxious over it because I'm thinking, I've just got to get this job. So I applied for it, did all the things, went for the interview and everything, and sure enough, I got it. So I was wrapped, absolutely wrapped. You know, within just being in there a couple of days, I thought, yeah, this is where I want to be. And the fact of working outside, you know, all those sorts of things on beautiful grass and everything, and then being able to take pride in what you did because, you know, you had to do everything right on a golf course, obviously. So it was just, it was great. So, so I was there. I started, I think, September. I started in there. No, that's not right. Yes, it was. October. It was the end of September. So I'd gone through and I'd been there for quite a while. And we're in June 2019. So, and it was about 2 weeks shy of the anniversary of my other accident. And my boss, Tim, it was a raining day. And we'd been pushing up piles and everything and just, you know, cutting up dead wood and whatever. And we were nearly finished, I suppose, and then Tim said to me, I'm going to knock off, I'm going to go to APSA. He said, would you mind just going pushing that pile up when you finish? And I said, yeah, no worries, I'll do that. So it's raining and everything like that, but I went and pushed it up and I thought I'll duck down to this other one down the back and push that up as well and everything. And I came back, and by this stage, when I'm probably, you know, 400 metres from the clubhouse and probably 500 metres from our shed. And I'm on an open front end loader tractor and it's pouring with rain. It's pretty wet and I'm satched. And so I was sort of going pretty quickly. And then, so I got back to the shed. And when I got back to the shed, I went to back the tractor in. And when you back the tractor in, it's, yeah, you just got to get it right or it can, or you might have to have another go and go forward and come back in because there's a tree there. So I've backed it in, realised I'm not right, and I've gone to go forward, and that's the last thing I remember. So somehow or other, because it was wet, obviously the tractor's wet, I'm wet, and everything like that, whatever happened, I don't know, but I actually slipped off the tractor and slipped in between the two wheels into the beside the wall of the shed. And the only reason I know that is because, as in falling in there, because it's the only possible place I could have fallen. Then what happened on, it's amazing in that over that next probably 3-4 minutes, whatever it was, there is stuff that is so clear in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's obviously, I was once again in and out of consciousness and just don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So how I fell off, why I fell off, I got no idea.
Mm.
What happened, just, yeah. I've racked my brain a little bit, but I don't know what happened. The first bit when I became conscious, I realised I was pinned against the wall. So the tractor's going.
Mm.
The wheels are trying to turn or are turning, but obviously the forks on the front of the loader are pushed into the ground and won't allow it. So consequently, the back must want to go over towards the wall. Yeah, so I was pinned against the wall and I remember thinking, I was trying to push against the tractor, but obviously that wasn't going to happen. Mm. But it's what you do, I suppose. It's a natural thing. So I did it, whether I'd gone unconscious or not and how long I was doing it for, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Then next thing I realised, and the actual tractor wheel is spinning me around. I was just like a rag doll.
God.
So I'm spinning around and I could feel my left ankle just sort of flicking every time I was going around and everything, and I thought that it had been severed off basically and was just hanging by something, and I wasn't really sure, but and then all of a sudden there was more pressure again on the wall, and then I just, all of a sudden I could hear all my ribs breaking when I was on the, well, whether it was on the frame of the wall or metal, but I could just hear it. I just knew that they were just, every time I'd hit the wall, another rib would break or whatever.
What was it like in that moment to hear and know your ribs were breaking and were probably going to continue to break as long as, was that like?
I think it was a moment of just, I'm going to die.
Mm.
I don't think there was ever a panic, or there was originally, when I tried to push against it, but I think that stage had gone past and it was just, I'm gone here. This is, so, because I don't remember saying or yelling or doing anything or like that, whether I did or not, I don't know.
Mm.
And I just thought, well, I'm going to die. I mean, I've got a tractor pinning me against the wall here, and it's not, and it's going and it's not going to stop. So, and all of a sudden then I must have gone to the ground or stopped spinning, whatever it was, where the wheel was still going. But for some reason, obviously my mind clicks in and I go, and I started moving my fingers. I checked to see whether I was a quadriplegic or paraplegic or whatever. I thought, oh, no, my hands, my fingers are moving.
Yeah.
And then my toes are going, but I never quite got the one with my ankles severed off and my toes. Like, I never put those two together at the time.
Yeah.
But I just straight away thought, okay, I'm not a paraplegic, I'm not a quadriplegic. Then all of a sudden, obviously, gone unconscious again, and then next thing, I'm bolt upright against the wall. So obviously the wheel picked me up again at some stage and put me up against the wall, and I was just bolt upright and couldn't move. At that time, because of the day, I'd like a shirt and a jumper on, and I had a vest on as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had a raincoat on because I'd been out on the tractor. So I'm against the wall, and then all my clothing just went tight. All of a sudden, just went tight on me. But when it went tight, I couldn't breathe.
Right.
And when I say I couldn't breathe, it was just nothing. It was just total bang.
Mm.
And there was, it was the weirdest.
Do you have any idea how long that was
for? No, I don't. I don't. And I remember standing there and just thinking, once again, well, this is it. I'm gone this time because I can't breathe.
God.
And I've said to people, you see things in people movies, and people gasping for air and everything. It doesn't happen that way.
Because you couldn't even gasp.
It doesn't breathe. No, there was nothing. It was like, it was just like someone shutting the door, bang, the door shut.
Wow.
So it was shut. And it was instant, and I'm just standing there. And the amazing thing is, once again, in that situation, I thought, okay, well, this is it. I'm gone this time.
Mm.
But I'm not in pain. And I actually made this thing in my mind, or thought of this in my mind. I thought, well, at least this isn't going to be a painful death.
Mm-hmm.
It is. But never did it enter my mind again where I have this fear of death.
Mm.
Did that enter? It didn't come into it.
Mm.
And it never came into it with either accident or any period. Mm. It was just, okay, this is it, it's my time. Mm. And I didn't think about anything else.
Mm.
So, yeah, I was in that situation. Then, out of the blue, once again, no idea how long, here I am, I'm down on the ground again, pinned against the wall. And I actually thought, what the hell happened there?
Mm.
But not even knowing whether that was, you know, a second, a minute,
mm-hmm.
who knows mm-hmm. what it was, I don't know.
Mm.
And so I'm pinned in, I could feel the tire of the tractor going around a little bit on my back. Mm. So whether that was actually on the back or whatever, but I remember it either going around or seeing it or whatever. I don't, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I'm pinned on the ground. My right shoulder's pinned in hard against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I can't move it,
mm-hmm.
But I can move my fingers. So once again, I went through all that again.
Mm-hmm.
What made me do those things at those time? I don't know. But I was there and I thought, okay, I wonder if I can move my left hand. And I just could move my hand a bit, but I couldn't move my arm.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realised that where it was situated was right where my phone was, in my pocket,
mm-hmm.
even though it was on the outside. I thought, this is my only chance. I thought, I've got to get this phone. I've got to get to my phone.
Mm.
So, God. As a lot of people say, how in the hell did you make all these decisions?
I'm sitting here thinking I can't even comprehend.
As has been explained to me by medical people, that is just the nature of some people and other people.
Yes.
I go back to the accident with the chainsaw. A lot of people would have just folded there and then their scalp's off the head and they're pouring with blood and whatever. Don't worry. There was a moment where I thought, well, I'll just kneel here and go up to the ground because I thought, I'm gone. So, but there was a bit of that old strength that clicked in there and got me through and making decisions and making the right decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, that's where I was with this one. But because this one, I said back with the accident with the chainsaw and I just, it wasn't a matter of, am I going to die? I knew I was going to die sort of thing. And this one, well, I was well and truly past thinking whether I was going to die. She was all over. And knowing that the other two blokes that worked there have gone, there was, but I was aware there's some people up at the clubhouse still, but that meant nothing.
Yeah.
Because they would see the lights on my vehicle there and they just drive past and go home. Yeah. Just thinking I'm still there because they would have seen me go past in a tractor and all this sort of stuff. So they wouldn't have thought twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on the ground, I'm thinking, right, I've got to get to my phone. Now I've got the raincoat, the jacket, and my jumper, and they've all got zips on them. I'm thinking, how in the hell am I going to get these zips open? And I couldn't really, and I thought, I've got to get to them as well with my finger, but I couldn't move my arm.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I sort of grabbed the jumper a little bit, or grabbed the jacket, and I got it close enough. I thought, well, how often does a zip come down if it's not straight or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You were thinking that at the time.
Yeah, I did. So I did it. The next thing it came down, I thought, wow, I've got two to go. So then I got the jacket, I got the raincoat down, I got the jacket down, and then I got my jumper. I think, don't you be the one to stuff me up here. Mm-hmm. Whatever. I remember thinking that, I got two down, surely the two.
Mm-hmm.
I got it down, and that was no worries. So then I'm trying to get my fingers into my shirt to get hold of my phone, and I can feel it with the tips, but I can't get hold of it, and it won't move. And I'm just thinking, I'm so close, but I can't get it. And I know I stopped briefly, and then I thought, I'll have another go. And I got in there, and I just, with the clips of my fingers, because I had a cover on my phone and it had a ridge on it, with one fingernail, I just pulled it enough that I could actually get the tips of my fingers onto it, and I got it out.
Wow.
Now, the amazing stupid thing about all this is I've been going around the wall and tractor. I've been belted up against everything, and I realised I still had my glasses on.
Wow.
I thought, what are they? How does this happen?
Yeah.
I was thinking, because I got my phone out. No idea to what my injuries were.
Mm.
Obviously, I was in shock and whatever and didn't realise how bad they were. And whatever.
But your glasses were clear and your
glasses were clear. And that's the thing, and because the people that came down later just said that I was just covered in dirt.
Yeah.
Just looked disgusting. And yet I could see through these glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, right, I'll give Tim a ring, my mm-hmm. boss.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing he's an absent now, Tim never has his phone on him. Mm-hmm. If he does, he never answers it mm-hmm. or whatever. I thought, oh, I've got to have a crack at it. Mm-hmm. Ring.
Mm-hmm.
So I rang him. So once again, all the good fortune from the actual moment of the accident, to be able to get my phone out, it started happening all over again. And I've rung Tim's phone. Just he happened to, this is later finding out, he got to Apsley.
Mm-hmm.
He said he pulled up, taken his safety belt off, and he said he'd actually had one leg out of the door and was about to go when the phone rang on the passenger seat. Now, Tim wouldn't have looked at that phone.
Right? Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have gone there again for two hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rang him and I said, I don't know the exact words. I remember saying of that big accident in the shed, I'm being pinned under the tractor and I'm in a fair amount of trouble here.
All right. Do you remember his response?
No.
I can't even imagine what he must have thought.
I don't remember a word he said. Mm. And I said, there's people up at the clubhouse, ring them.
Mm-hmm.
So he rang the clubhouse and then that was the last I.
Right.
I don't remember anything. So they all come down. And luckily, as you know, Melville Proud, who's been brilliant, both him and Tim, who's Melville's the president of the club, he said to me, he said, if I'd have been there by myself, he said, I wouldn't have known how to get the tractor off you, what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it just happened there was a couple of farmers there and whatever. So
so
they went to work and then one of the amazing things is for some reason or other when I got there, my phone was out the front of the shed, out from where the tractor was.
Right.
So that's just a total mystery to how on earth it ever got out there. I was unconscious obviously for a fair while in there. And then someone spoke to me, one of them, and then all of a sudden one of them asked, how do you get into your phone? What's your code? And I gave them the code of my phone, how to get in, what the numbers were to get in there.
Yeah.
And then they said, who are we ringing? Now, this is the biggest problem because my wife, who was a travel agent, she had a group in France at the time, so she was just out of Paris.
Yeah.
So that one wasn't much good.
No.
My eldest son, Sam, was living and working in London, so that wasn't much good. And then Nathan lives at Gove at Nullumboy, right up the top of Australia. So there wasn't, and I thought, I think my brother and sister are in my favourites. And I said,
good old favourites again.
Yeah. So I said, I'll try my brother Chris and my sister Cole, see if they're in there. So they rang my sister first. And she was just 2 hours out of a hip operation in Betty Kay, so she wasn't much good. And then they got hold of my brother. So he put the wheels in motion as far as that went. But, I'd made that. And one thing that I will remember through it all and is so, so clear is a bloke by the name of Alan Marshall who – he was involved in our football club out of Borders, and I've known him for years, and he's with the CFS here.
Mm-hmm.
They were called, obviously, and I remember being on the tractor at one stage and I just heard his voice, and my nickname being Punter, and he just goes, Punter, not long and we'll get you out of here. And I just, that was a great moment to hear a voice I knew.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was a great moment. So. How long, whatever it took, I got no idea. I don't really know. I just remember leaving in the ambulance from the golf club. Don't remember anything about the hospital. Don't remember getting to the hospital or whatever.
You would have been flown out pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that was once again more luck there too. I do remember leaving the hospital, being put into the ambulance at the hospital because Dr. Brian Norcox said, look, obviously, I opened my eyes and did something. He said, oh, you're all right, mate. You're on your way to Adelaide. It'll be all good. And, yeah, I just remember that. Then when I got out to the airport, it was raining and they're kind of trying to keep me dry and got me into the plane. I remember I was a bit fortunate because there was a doctor on board and it was the brand-new jet that they had and it was its first week
of operation. He said, well, you're in business. It's going to take 20 minutes less than it normally does.
Wow.
And everyone, that was dark.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was, I'm not too sure, time of night or whatever, but he said to me, like, he said, oh, do you want the lights on or lights off? Because it was dark. And I said, oh, I couldn't give a damn. I remember saying it and everything.
You're not fussy.
No. So away we went. And later to find out that that was, you know, as I said, there was a lot of things that went my way and after the actual incident of the accident, but was that that actual plane had been flown, had gone to Mildura, had come back to Murray Bridge and was about to head to Millicent when it got called, no, don't worry about it. And then they got the call. I said, oh, no, head to Narracourt. So, you know, I was just fortunate that I didn't have to wait for hours and hours and hours for a plane. Don't remember anything about getting to the airport or anything like that. I remember them saying, we're coming into the RIH now. And then nothing until I went straight into emergency. One of the nurses goes, oh, you're from Narracourt, I see. I used to come from Padua. I'm sort of like, oh, I couldn't give a damn where you come from. And I don't even know who it was or whatever. Yeah. It's not thinking. So,
small talk wasn't what you were after at that time.
So
you had a bit of time in hospital after that. I assume they got you stabilised. Was it a worrying night for them? What was the talk?
I suppose it was the damage that was done. And when I say that, in a way I was lucky, but, yeah, I've got 18% burns to my body. They're friction burns from the tyre. So whether that was the tyre spinning against me or spinning over the top of me, I don't know. So they start from the middle of my back down across my left buttocks, down my left leg. My shoulder, which wasn't an issue at the time, all my ankle basically and the ribs. I mean, anyone's broken ribs just know they're sore.
Not a lot you can do about them.
Consequently, that next morning, because I don't really remember, and I was doctors just, you know, there was people coming from everywhere and they're trying to talk to me, and I was obviously drugged up. I remember thinking, just do whatever you got to do. I don't know. But of course, someone's got to make that call. And my brother and sister-in-law, they got there pretty early the next day. They live in Horsham. And anyway, so I don't know whether they had anything to this day, whether they had anything to do with any decisions or whatever, but they couldn't do anything initially because my first operation that had to take place was I had to go in. As gross as it sounds, I actually had to take the rubber from the tyre out of my back.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was I don't know why or whatever, how hard it was to the job or whatever, but that was the first operation. So they had to do that, clean it, sanitise it, let things take place. Then I think it was probably 2-3 days later, I was to go back into the operation. And when I say that was to start skin grafting and everything. And I had a big call to make because my dream in life was to go and watch the Ashes at Lord's in England. And for 30 years I wanted to do it, and we had tickets. It was 6 weeks away, and we had tickets, you know, to go. Also all ready to rock and roll, and also to catch up with Sun Sam, who was over there. And so the biggest decision I had to make is, you can either have it grafted from him yourself, as in, you know, donor site from somewhere in your body, or you can get what they now grow, skin. And I said, so what's the best one to do? And they said, the grown skin does the best.
Long term.
It will heal better. And they said about, but it takes longer to heal than if we take a donor site from you. So I explained to him what I wanted to do. And one of the doctors happened to be, love his cricket, and he said, righto, well, you go on to England, we'll do the graft, we'll take it off your body.
Yeah.
And I said, right. But I didn't realise at the time, and you know, everyone says it now, donor sites are the worst part of the whole burn process. And still now, as much as I'm down the track, my burns area is pretty good, but my donor site
is still nerve endings.
Yeah, it's better. It's only, you know, it goes the length of my thigh and up the back of my leg. But, it's probably only a little area of probably, you know, 10 centimetres, but it's still sore.
Yeah,
it's still
sore.
Anyhow, that's a small...
Just to
small,
remind you.
Yeah. And it's a small price to pay. So we went in and so that decision was made and we went through it. And there was a, I'm not quite sure how long it was until Therese got back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say it's probably 4 or 5 days after it, but when she got there.
That must have been absolutely
And the worst thing was probably for the boys trying to find out what was going on. Luckily that... At this stage, really, no one knew too much what was where I was. I suppose, but I remember Sam ringing me one day and just laughing on the end of the phone. And I said, "What's your problem?" And he goes, "You're high as a kite, Dad."
Oh.
And I said, "So I just came to the nurse and said, 'Do you speak to my son?'"
Well, at least he knew you weren't in pain.
So. So we did that, and one of the doctors came and he said, "Oh, I've got a picture of your x-ray of your back from where the tire got in." I said, "Okay." He said, "Do you want to see it?" And I said, "Oh, yeah."
Mm.
What it was a photocopied piece of paper. It was just black.
Oh.
And he said, "See, this has got Dunlop written in the middle of it." And I said, "Oh, you and I'll get on the right." So that was the early process and where it was at.
Mm-hmm.
And
then,
Of course, from there on it was treatment, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So just tell me, did you get to the Ashes?
No.
You didn't get there because of all of the grafts?
I suppose we were 4 weeks in.
Yeah.
Or 3 weeks
in. Yeah. How long were you in hospital for?
I was 49 days in Adelaide. Okay. And we were, it was about the 3-week mark or something like that. And I remember Trey's just saying to me, "You know, we're not going to England." And I said, I've worked that out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no hope, absolutely none. I wouldn't have gone 6 months later, probably, as it turned out. That was never going to happen, really, after it all. But, at least at the start it was something to work to, you know, like the pain that I was going through and that sort of thing. So the process basically started within, I suppose, after the first operation was to, and if I thought not the first, but the actual one when I started to clean me up and get things happening, it was probably 5 days. So from there on, it was all about the nurses and the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally in their control. There was nothing I could do other than them. So I made sure that I was nice to them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure you would have been one of their favourites.
But, it was that process because I initially was getting the dressings changed every day and everything, but that was just a killer in the past. Big one of the reasons being the ribs issue, but I was on my back and they had to roll me over every day to do it, and it was no fun.
No.
It was just when my wife was there and they were about to do it, I said, "Look, I think you need to go and get a coffee." And everything, because I didn't want to hear. Because I would just roar like a bull, absolutely.
Wow.
And the language wasn't great either. No. But I'd always apologise. And the nurses were all, they said, "It's fine. You're not swearing at us. I don't think you just let it rip. It makes you feel better and whatever." And that was one of the things. I never complained, really. I just knew this is where we're at. Mm-hmm. It's a process. Everyone's doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it started. And they didn't do much more than that, really, than other than the dressings and all that.
Yeah.
One of the sort of problems with the dressings used to be it was the ointment, it was the burns and everything like that. But there's this smell. Never did I take to that well.
Yeah.
Whether it was the ointment, whether it was the mixture of both, I don't know. But I just, because every time they would roll me over or whatever to change sheets and everything, and I'd just see the bed and it'd just be covered in blood.
And
you just think blood and gooey stuff and you think yuck, or whatever. But anyway, it, you know, it didn't take that long, I suppose, to think, well, right, this is the process, and we just got to go through it.
And the fact that you had faith in them and put yourself in their hands, which obviously you needed to, but to make their job so much smoother meant you could recover quicker.
Yeah. I mean, you're in no position in it. No. You just got to do what they say.
That some people might fight it. They might try and fight the process, but it's just no point, is there?
No, it's not. And, you know, the amount of doctors and nurses and the different people that were coming in and out, it was just amazing. Like, in the end, like, they all told me what they did, but, of course, early days and medication, you take a little bit, you don't take it all. And I had no idea what half of them were, and they just keep coming in and out and think, do whatever you got to do. Do whatever you got to do. But it was, as I said, it was out of my control. But a stage came where it was my control.
So when the stage came that it was within your control, was there a defining moment or what was that?
Yeah, spot on. It was a really defining moment. Because the talk of they were going to wanted to get me, stand me up. At this stage, I at least 3 weeks in, if not four, I basically hadn't moved from my bed. So there were some bad moments in it. I look back, there were moments now that have triggered a few things where I'm at the moment. But it's one of those things where, you know, I didn't go to the toilet for 9 days.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, obviously the pressure's on, you got to start.
Yeah, getting your body working. Yeah.
I tried some things and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And after we finally, they got me to go to the toilet and it was a great moment.
Yeah.
as gross back as it all sounds.
Back to normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost. So
it happened. And but then there was a bad moment. I said to them, I said, because the nurses, you know, they were just brilliant. But they were always busy. So even if you called them or whatever, pushed your buzzer, they couldn't get there straight away every time or whatever.
Yeah.
No try. But I did say to one of the nurses once, I said, what happens, like after I'd gone to the toilet, I said, what happens if I need to go again? And she said, just push your buzzer. I said, yeah, what happens if you don't get here? And she said, well, unfortunately, just do it. And I couldn't quite comprehend that. I am not going to do it. I'm a 58-year-old bloke or 56-year-old. No, I'm not going to do it. Well, the moment came and I'm thinking, God, get here. And I'm trying, and I couldn't.
Yep.
And that was a really awful moment to think, I'm half a fit bloke that age. And I've just done this in bed, and I'm lying in it. And I just, that took me a day or so to get over that. But the consequence of that down the track was, well, I was working again, so I could go to the toilet.
Yeah, absolutely. And from a healthcare perspective, that's something that's dealt with all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
But, the dignity.
Yeah. Well, my dignity had gone in many ways because the amount of times they just come in and roll you over and leave you there naked because they wanted you that time to air out or whatever, you know. So, I lost that early in the piece, I suppose, in some ways. But, so that moment then was, one of those moments where I thought, I've got to get once I'm ready to go here, I've got to go. So they said to me one day, they came in and they said, oh, we're going to get you to stand up today. And I said, oh, right, no worries. I said, and I was looking forward to it, but then part of me going, oh no, just imagine the pain I'm going to go through for this. And I said, oh, okay, no worries. And it must have been on Saturday because then my wife was there and I was one of the blokes that I used to play sport with. He was in the room and I was very lucky because the amount of friends that travelled up and saw me were just unbelievable. And then the amount of people that I'd played football or whatever with. And you and had retired to either Adelaide or lived in Adelaide, they just come regularly so they were great. They were better than medicine. Seriously were.
Yeah.
But this Saturday afternoon and so Teresa's standing there with this person called Noel Tiver and she said, oh yeah, they're gonna stand him up today. All right, that's no worries. And she said, no, well, he's gotta learn to walk again. And that had never entered my mind. That just had not entered my mind. So that hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think that was the moment I thought, right, if you're going to stand me up, we're where are you? Mm-hmm. This is my time.
Mm.
I'm taking over.
Mm.
You do what you want to do, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I stood up and it wasn't any fun.
No.
And they just said, right, you can sit down. And I said, well, what am I going to do now? And they said, no, that's all we wanted you to do.
Yep.
I went, oh, mm-hmm. So then, yeah, over that course of period of time,
mm-hmm.
The next day I got up and I just had to move a foot centimetre each way or whatever, mm-hmm. and then gradually to get to that stage of walking.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that was hard work.
Mm, I bet.
Really, really hard work. It hurt.
Mm.
All those sorts of things, you know. I mean, yeah, there's X amount of pain you can describe, but you can't describe. Like, you got the burns and everything like that, and your ankles all swollen and everything, but you've got to walk,
mm-hmm.
but you've got to do it.
Yeah, you've got to push yourself through that pain.
So, yeah, so consequently that was over a period. I was just slowly crying. So, yeah, that was just one of those. It was good moment because now I was in control,
mm.
but they were sort of telling me don't push yourself too hard, yep. or whatever. And so that was I understood that. I'd go out to the window in the wheelchair and look out,
mm-hmm.
up the end. Railway tracks never look so great.
I bet.
But by the end of it, I've never seen it more ugly as in my life. So at least I did that.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go outside. That was great, fresh air. That was
mm-hmm.
one of those moments in a wheelchair.
Mm.
So I was in this situation, learning to walk, doing everything. And it was only probably the one time I really complained was doctors would come and go all the time, and they would tell me in the morning, right, the doctors are coming in. They want to, we've got to take the dressings off. We're going to see them. So and the dressings, they hurt. Mm, take on and off, and all that sort of thing. And so I said, it's no worries. So this morning was there when I go right up to. Because they said to me, like, today we want you to walk up the end of the passage and back,
mm-hmm.
But the doctors want to see. The doctors didn't come, so they put the dressings back on.
Yeah, okay.
So what happens there is, of course, you're being rolled over and back all the time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the pain was starting to ease at this stage, obviously, but still was sore. So then because what actually happened thereafter is that some of it hadn't taken, so I had to go back in and have a bit of that done again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was this day. So the second time comes in, this guy, I've got some bad news. And I said, what's that? Mm-hmm. And they said, the plastics want to see your burns. And I said, well, how's that going to work? And they said, you're going to have to roll you over. And I said, oh, serious?
Mm-hmm.
So I accepted that. That was all right. No worries. Then next thing, mm-hmm. I'm back. I'm over. Been rolled over. And they come in. They said, no, the doctors are going to be here in half an hour. And I said, you're kidding me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, that was about the only time that I got a little bit
frustrated.
But the nurses, they were as frustrated probably as what I was. Mm-hmm. I could see it in their face. Mm-hmm. Like, you could just see that they were,
mm-hmm.
they were half smiling but half not. They
mm-hmm.
weren't
mm-hmm.
happy either. So anyhow, so I got into that situation where I was walking, and I sort of, as I said, I started, this is my moment to be in that control.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a big moment in it all that I'm walking down the passage and I've gone walk past this person. There's an area that probably not a lot of people get into, public don't get into. And there was an old lady that had her legs burnt,
mm-hmm.
and she was in this room. And it wasn't a pretty sight.
Mm.
And I immediately thought, God, I've got no issues.
Mm-hmm.
Then a bit further on, then there was a young bloke in another room.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been there for a long, long time. And
mm-hmm.
his future didn't look great. So it rocked me, but it also gave me a kick to say, okay,
yeah,
right, mate, you got no issues.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty worse people off than you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get on it.
Human
so,
nature.
I got back and it pushed me to make sure that I did get going and everything. So it was all right. And it was also that moment where, as I said, that with the nurses this day, that it was the first time I was shitty, for want of a good, better word.
Mm-hmm.
And but I got over it. And I was there, and then it wasn't long after that, this other doctor came in, and I could never work out who she was or what she did, but she used to come in every day.
Mm-hmm.
And she made the comment to me, and she just said, look, I know they want to get you up and going and mm-hmm. get you out and perhaps get you down to Flinders or if not back to Mount Gambier. And she said, don't be surprised, though, if something goes, you get a little bit of a hiccup and things go wrong.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Well, sure enough, I got a blood clot in the lung, and that put things back. Sort of a setback. And so we had to deal with that. And that obviously, yeah, was probably a period there where, you know, put it this way, when they realised they either had the blood clot or I was having a heart attack, one or the other, yeah, I went whizzing out of the room pretty quickly and all that sort of stuff.
Where did you say the clot was?
In my lung.
In your lung, yeah. Did you have any trouble breathing at
that time? No. I had a bit of pain. There was a bit of pain in my chest and it was on the right side and everything. But anyway, so we, you know, had to deal with it and everything. But then in that situation, I sort of thought, well, if I'm going to be here for longer, these nurses that I've been dealing with, I got to get to know them better and whatever. And, and I got on very, very well with them all, and they were all different ages and whatever. But, they were great. They were great. And then I thought, so I sort of started, you know, mucking around with them a bit and whatever, and found out what they were married, divorced, separated, whatever, kids, family, what they did. And all that. So it became a bit of a joke. And then they started playing jokes on me and stuff. And it was good. It was a great relationship. And one moment that happened was with one of the nurses was that she had her time off. It was 4 days off and she came back. But she went on to tell me, she said, oh, and I got on really, really well with her. And I said, she obviously had a bit of an issue with the son and whatever. And one day I said, oh, it's, you know, you don't look very happy or something today. She said, oh, no, nothing like that. And I worked out it wasn't work or anything. And, but anyway. She had the 4 days off, and then when she came back, she said to me, she said, oh, it's good to be back at work. And I said, oh, why is that? She said, well, I was nearly going to have a sickie today. I said, why are you going to have a sickie? She said, oh, I had a few issues at home and whatever and everything like that. And they're probably not meant to say anything like that, but it was just
human
the way it worked.
Human.
Yeah, yeah, and it was the way when we got on. I mean, and she, and as I said, I'd made a real conservative effort to get on with everybody. And she said, oh, I said to my husband, she said, oh, no, I will go. I'm going to go to work and everything like that. And he said, oh, you're right. And she said, oh, well, I just know that I'm in ward, whatever it was, and floor, da-da-da. And she said, if I have a bad night, I'll just go in and have a talk to Richie for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
So that made me feel good, I thought. So she told me that, and I thought, oh, this is working, you know. Like she, so, yeah, so, you know, we got had a good relationship and, so, that, you know, it was good. And then when I actually left and went out on the flying doctors on the stretcher, there was Jeannie was a name. She, I don't know how old Jeannie was, but she was no spring chicken, but she ran the place. And she was a hard taskmaster for the girls and everything like that, for the nurses, but she knew what she was doing and they all related to her and they all thought she was good and everything. But when I got on, I was about to get on the stretcher, she said, oh, hang on. Come here. I said, what's that? She said, I want to give you a hug. And I said, righto, Jeannie. So she gave me a hug and she said, I've only ever done that once before in 39 years. That was good.
You left your mark.
Yeah, it was a good moment. Because even when I went back there months later for a checkup, you know, all the nurses all said, geez, have a look who's walking down here. And
that must be so nice
for them
to see.
Well, even the actual boss, what he was having lunch somewhere and he actually – when I was leaving, came and saw me, said, oh, not many people come and do that.
Yeah.
So it was good. It was good to see that.
Yeah.
So I'd gone down that journey of, getting everyone on site, I suppose, and learning to walk. And And, I mean, even when I left, walking was a real issue. It wasn't that easy. I couldn't sit. So I flew back from out Gambia. There's no way known could I have ever sat in a chair or whatever. So there was a couple of days in Mount Gambier and a couple of days in Narracourt and then home.
And so what was it like once you got home? Were you still having community health nurses coming?
That probably went on for 2 months.
Yeah, okay.
It was funny because everyone was sort of saying, you know, it'd be great to get home, da-da-da, and everyone. That night I wanted to get home.
Yeah,
I wanted to be home. The boys wanted to be home.
Yeah.
The trees wanted to be home, everything like that. But after a few days, it was tough.
Oh, I bet it was. You probably didn't realise just what was being done for you that once you're home, although I'm sure Therese did a lot for you, but it's the nursing side of things.
Yeah, and it's just I couldn't sleep. Thank God the cricket was on TV because I'd watch it. I'd better. Yeah, I was in pain.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a worse place, probably at home, which I've never really said about.
Yeah, okay.
But for that, you know, first 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
it was murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I went to sleep or go to bed, I'd be 2 hours before I'd go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that could be 12 o'clock, 1
mm-hmm.
o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd wake up every 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So a good night for me was to get to sleep within 2 hours
mm.
and probably wake up 15, 20 times during mm-hmm. the night. Mm-hmm. That was a good night.
I suppose you'd also been so used to having OBS done and
for sure. And so yeah, I mean, that was a bit to get through in there. One, I remember when I was sort of thinking, I'll try and sleep on my side.
Mm-hmm.
And because what had happened was I'd got overweight and then I'd lost 24 kilos before the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but then when I went into hospital, I lost 14 kilos. Wow. So it's all muscle.
Yep.
So when I was in bed trying to sleep and I was on my side, I actually couldn't have my legs on each other.
Yeah, bone.
Knee on knee, just the pain and everything. So
did you learn to put pillows between
your legs? I tried everything
and
it just didn't seem to work.
Yeah, okay.
I was never comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so and if I went to go on my side and had leg on leg,
mm-hmm.
It was within 5 seconds I'd have to stop
mm-hmm.
and get back. So, when you finally get back to sleeping, it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they were tough moments. Like going because, like my wife had put ointment on me in the morning and night and all sorts of stuff, trying to shower, bending over, couldn't do it and everything. And they were tough moments in that I thought, to go to the toilet I had to use a commode
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't bend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how long is this going to go on for?
Yeah.
And then when you sort of go, you start wiping, you look after yourself and you're in the shower, you get out of the shower and you're trying to dry yourself.
Yeah.
But you can't clean, you can't go any below your knees. You can't you can't dry your toe. You can't dry your feet. You can't do it. And you just think, once again, how long is this going to go on for?
Yeah.
But, you do kick yourself back in the gear. You're going to say, all right, well, somewhere it's going to get better, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not going to get better, well, I've got to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose no one really told me at that stage because it wasn't going to get better or whatever. But I think I knew. So all through that period was tough.
So how mentally challenging has it all been? I mean, you've been through some massive, massive things. Yeah, you got through such amazingly hard times. What's the toll that it takes on you after all that?
Oh, it's a matter of, you try to digest everything.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to digest it all, you think what's right and what's wrong, what effect it has on me, what effect it has on other people, all those sort of things. So mentally at this stage, I'm thinking I'm okay, I'm in control, but I was a bit aware of it. I was a bit aware that I was sort of thinking, okay, I've got issues, I just got to deal with them and whatever. But then there's a stage where that all accumulates, I suppose, and you think, where am I heading here?
Yeah.
Not that it was worrying me greatly, but I'm just sort of thinking, I thought, I hope things can keep going all right and I don't lose control where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it did. It happened out of the blue.
Mm.
One night I'm just watching TV. I watch a plane crash on TV.
Mm-hmm.
The plane bursts into flames and bang. Mm-hmm. It was like I just went all hot in the face and thought, what the hell's going on? Had to get up and walk away. So that was my way of dealing with it. I was getting up and walking away, whether that was right or wrong, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember thinking to myself, what just happened to me?
Mm-hmm.
Then the next night was September the 11th,
mm-hmm.
and they showed reenactments of the Twin Towers and all those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just remember seeing the one where they showed those people jumping out of the building, mm-hmm. and that hit me again.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't deal with it.
Mm.
Got up and walked away and I thought, no, I've got a bit of an issue here. Mm-hmm. So then not saying anything, not being me, being that tough guy that you think you are and whatever, and no one's going to break my walls down. It'll be all right. But then over the next sort of week, I suppose, there was two bad nights with dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I reenacted the accident
right.
a couple of times, but I overreacted the accident, as in
like exaggerated.
It was like, you know, I was in a shed. Oh, this, there was a tractor, it was on fire, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a shed and I was locked in and couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So why is this happening? And I thought, oh, I got to get help here.
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
so yeah. Those wheels got put in place, and you know, I told my wife about it, and so I dealt with it.
Yeah.
I went to the doctors, my mate, and one of the great things, the two doctors that I dealt with, they just said, well, you know, I said to them, I said, I feel weak and that I'm doing this, I'm soft. I always thought depression or whatever or these sort of things were people that were just weak people. And they put me in my place pretty well straight away. And just said, no, you're strong because you've come to us.
Mm-hmm.
You've come and said you've got a problem and you want to deal with it. That's strength.
Absolutely. And
so when they said that, that actually made me feel pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got in and I've started to deal with that. Mm-hmm. It's not completely because my issue really is just the moment is anxiety. There's no doubt about that. I have a bit of a if I'm out of my comfort zone, I just think, well, what's going to go wrong here? Whether that's, I presume it's because of the accident. And the other one is I have this fear of when's the next accident going to happen. And I've got to get past all that. But certainly now I've got a better understanding of don't do something that's not quite right to do. Rather than 5 years ago I would have kept going or whatever.
Yeah.
And done it. But now I'd just stop and go, no.
So just not put yourself at risk.
But yeah, I certainly I've got to deal with this. When's this next accident?
I'm sure you will. I have no doubt you will. I mean, look at what you've dealt with so far.
Well, I've got to deal with it.
That's
my theory.
Yeah.
That's my theory. You know, I mean, and it's a bit like I can't just let it roll on. I can't. So it's a bit like, you know, the old saying, you know, time doesn't stop for anybody. And it's so true. It's not, you know, I've got to go first. I can either be, you know, if I had a stopwatch, I can either be using the stopwatch on someone or I can be someone that's when the stopwatch is on. So, you know, I've got that control. And that's the way I've got to look at it.
Yeah.
And go, right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you just sit here and wait for it to happen. Well,
absolutely. Well, you're focusing on it, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we could all do that.
Yeah.
We'll wait for it to happen, but it's not going to give us much of a meaningful life.
No.
I don't think you would have gone through what you've gone through if there wasn't a bigger reason behind it, you know, and not twice.
No, that's right.
Maybe once, but not twice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm determined to, to get things in the right place.
Yes.
And everything like that, you know. I haven't been back to the golf club since.
Okay.
There is a fear there. I'm getting better at the thought of doing it. There's no doubt about that. Why that's there, I don't know. But we'll get through that at some stage.
Yeah.
And,
and I mean, there is at the end of the day, there's no rush. You don't have to do all these things yesterday.
No. And I have just such great people around me.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that I'm dealing with are just, you know, from my work case managers through to, you know, everybody, doctors, whatever. I just can't complain about anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And that gives me confidence.
Yep.
That I know that there's a path there and those people will guide me in the right way. So that's good. I'm happy with that.
I think you've done, like, just, I mean, anyone listening to this and anyone that has heard your story, family, friends, etc., what you've gone through is just huge, yet you've just dealt with it so well. And yeah, it's only any wonder that there'd be a couple of hiccups. There had to be a couple at some point.
I'm determined to come out the other side. I mean, you could sit and say, well, why did it happen to me? And and I'm never going to be 100% right, obviously.
Do you have those moments where you say, why did
it
happen?
No, no. No, not at all. Because it happened.
Yeah.
That's my theory.
Yep.
The first accident was just wrong place, wrong time. I was doing absolutely nothing wrong, you know. My fear of the second accident, probably I have that bit of a fear with that, is going, I hope I didn't do something stupid to cause that to happen. I hope it was an accident that, you know, just happened for no reasons other than it happened.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know that, I don't think, because I don't know what, you know.
More than likely it did just happen and it wasn't your...
And I think this part of me sort of goes, I don't want to know that. Because it happened and it's, and as I said, it's in the past and just got to deal with that and move on.
So you may have heard of the term, life doesn't happen to me, it happens for me. So if it happens to me, it's victim, you know, I'm a victim. If it happens for me, then I make something out of what's happened. So what have you learnt from all of this? What could you, what's your biggest learning curve?
Well, I mean, obviously we've got to live our lives within parameters to a bit from whether financial to what we have and everything like that. But I think really the one thing is, if you want to do something and do something different, provided it's all, you know, financially available to do, whether whether and by means, whether it's family and it can be done and everything, just do it. Because, you know, like, we've all got no idea what's going to happen around the track. I mean, who heard COVID-19
6 months
ago? Yes. And it destroyed the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a big comment, but at the same token, we just don't know where tomorrow leads. And you know, I mean, you don't do something ridiculous like you don't go out and buy, you know, $250,000 car because you'd like one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just
so you don't take the food off your table to do what you want to do.
But if you, you know, if you have that, you know, I look at it, you have that dream that you want to travel around Australia. Well, if it can be done, you know, and you're not going to upset the apple cart too much, but, you know, obviously to make a decision to do that, there's a few things you got to put in place. If you turn around and you go, well, we can do that, then do it, because when are you going to do it?
So what do you want to say about hard work when you're putting in those 90-hour weeks? What would you say to someone now who's working more than they're living, working more than they're sleeping, or with their family? You know, what would you say about
that? I mean, obviously they need to be done to a degree.
Yep.
But they can always be done better.
Yeah.
And obviously doing those sort of things, there's even financial reasons why you do that, because you do it because you think, you know, you're the right person to do it and everything. But then you've got to look back and you've probably got to take a bit of a, not step back, but just that moment occasion to say, well, hang on here. Is everything in place? I'm working, I'm making a living, but is home happy?
Yeah, balance.
Is there whatever? Would it be nice, you know, just to go down the street and have a coffee or whatever? Yeah. Because you don't do any of that.
Did you
stuff.
Even ever do
no,
that?
No. Not back then.
Have you done that a bit since?
I've done that.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
But, you know, things like that. I mean, so, you know, obviously, once again, there's financial reasons why people do those.
Of course.
Do those sort of things. But then you've got to say to yourself, well, is this all worth it? Am I in the right place?
And is it about surrounding yourself with a good, like, team that you can delegate to, or more so probably not necessarily delegating, but allowing yourself to delegate rather than I'll do it all myself?
Yeah, I mean, obviously depending what you're doing as far as industry-wise or whatever. But, yeah, in the best world you'd have someone you'd be delegating. You'd be having every second weekend off. You're working all weekends, then you'd say, right, I'll pay this bloke X or whatever, or you two blokes X, and we'll, you know, every second weekend we have off, whatever, like, and you work, I work, whatever those others or something around like that. But, yeah, I think when you take it all on board yourself, it just, you slowly go into a shell too. And I got no doubt that happened to me. You know, I mean, and a little bit different. And I think one thing from the accidents come out is I was a pretty emotionless person before that. I nothing worried me too much. I want to say worried me. Whereas I'm in that situation now, I go, if something upsets me or someone upsets me, a lot of the time I go, yeah, righto, and just move on.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whereas in the past I'd hold that
for
a while or whatever. Whereas now I might, if for that half hour, whether it be 10 minutes, half an hour, hour ago, you know, that's wrong, whatever it be. But then I'd forget about it. Just move on. And so I think, you know, I find now that even I have emotions, never knew I had them.
Yeah. I never knew I had them. They were under there.
Yeah, they were there. There's no doubt they were there. And there's a bit of a softy there now that half upsets me in some ways.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't upset Therese or
but it's, But it is. It is a bit of a. It is. It's that situation. You know, I can be. You know, I have said about it, but a bloke and I, you know, we were sparring partners on a footy field, and we played cricket against each other, and we weren't short of sort of telling each other how we thought they were going and all that sort of stuff and whatever. And once we've retired or whatever, we didn't sort of have much to do with each other, but then our paths crossed again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find, you know, only probably 6 weeks ago, he's having a few issues.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are on the side of the road pointing hearts out to each other.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, go, give that 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we basically didn't have the time, but here we are, two people that we thought were half tough and half whatever.
Yeah.
And like we're telling each other exactly where we're at.
Yeah.
On the side of the road.
Yeah.
And when I walked away, I actually felt great.
Mm, mm.
Because of getting that back from him.
Yes, of course.
And then him listening to me.
Yeah.
And I just thought, geez.
Mm. I bet he felt the same.
Yeah. I just said, well, this is just unreal.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know? And it's, I even had that moment where the eyes water up a bit. Mm-hmm. Like, that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Never happened. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's sitting there, he's not sitting, but he's standing there telling me, I said, oh, geez, even when something comes on TV now, mm-hmm. I said, yeah, mate. He said, oh, I'm hopeless. I burst into tears. He said, you're telling me that.
Mm-hmm.
Not you're only just admitting it, you're telling me.
Yeah.
And I thought, cool, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, you'd hope in an ideal world people, younger guys, can learn from this and, take off those tough exteriors a little bit sooner than waiting 20 years, you know.
Yeah,
and it's not to say you have to become, as you called it, soft. Like, it's not soft.
No,
it's actually strong.
Yeah, well, that's, I've had that explained to me. Wouldn't they explain it the way they do?
Yeah.
And it's very much like, as I said, it was just one sentence said to me that,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is strong
mm-hmm.
and that may make you feel so good.
Yeah.
Opposed to if someone says there's no idea of mm-hmm. where people are at, they mm-hmm. think they do, mm-hmm. or whatever, and they say it like that one wrong sentence,
yeah,
it goes the other way.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that, but I'm just saying that's what
mm-hmm.
could happen. So my thing to everything, to everybody, would mm-hmm. be a listener, don't be a teacher.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's times you can teach. I mean, if you're a
mm-hmm.
carpenter, you've got an apprentice, mm-hmm. yes, you're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But don't talk about stuff you don't know about,
especially
when you get into this situation about mm-hmm. people's health and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen.
I think it's one of the most highly underrated skills is listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are all so quick to talk, but listening is where it's at.
Yeah, I mean, we see it in the world we live in right at this very moment. Mm-hmm. People have got all these things about people's lives and COVID and whatever, and you hear some people on TV, we'll just say we're right at that moment now with Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
But then you hear some people talking, you go, well, hang on, do you really know what you're talking about here? Do you know what you're saying?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Be careful.
You're totally contradicting yourself and you're going off the wrong way here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, you know, I love it when people go, every life matters.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. So, you can say, hang on, I know for sure that every life matters.
Yeah. And you just got to be, take people around you,
mm-hmm.
accept them and like them.
Yeah, of course.
Like, basically, like, just so mm-hmm. easy to take for granted, you know, like, my wife's at work today, she comes home tonight,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. whatever, goes for a walk, cooks mm-hmm. tea, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's also in, with your children, you know, one's, well, Sam now lives in Melbourne and mm-hmm. Naples and all. We speak, but, mm-hmm. you know, do we really ever say, how you going? How you getting on?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever ask that hard question.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And each one.
And I've still got to learn that.
And it is a learning curve, isn't it? I think we all need to learn it.
Yeah.
You're not alone there. And I think the more people that, you know, realise that it is about asking the other person how you're going, it's...
And I'm not good at it. I know it's there, it's got to be done, but I've got to make myself better at that.
I think you're getting pretty good at these things. I think you can give yourself a little bit of credit. Well, thank you very, very much for your time today, Richie. And I look forward to hearing how you're going in the future and
It'll all be good.
I'm sure, I have no doubt you would have inspired a few today with this one. So enjoy the coming days and the end of June.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good on you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to In the Head of a Country Bloke. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more unique episodes, please follow or subscribe on your choice of platform. For any information on my coaching services, please feel free to privately message me on either Instagram or Facebook, or email me at mandy@mandykernocoach.com, and I look forward to chatting to you soon.